Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Hey everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29th, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30th, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1st, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2nd, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4th, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5th, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at themeateater.com. Hope to see you at the show.
Hi, I'm Jason Phelps, and I'm the new host of Cutting the Distance. Growing up in the Pacific Northwest, I've been hunting for about as long as I can remember. It didn't take long, though, for my love of hunting to turn into a love of calling animals in. This obsession ultimately led me to starting Phelps Game Calls back in 2009. Since then, I've learned damn near everything there is to know about building calls, as well as how to use them effectively in the field. Get them close. That's always been my mantra. In my opinion, there isn't a more exciting way to hunt. So in this podcast, we're going to cover everything about using the calls, everything about the hunting tactics that surround using the calls, as well as times when using calls just isn't the right thing to do. So how do we get there? We get there through questions from you. We get there by leveraging my own personal experience, which is going to include a lot of failures and a lot of success. And we get there through conversations with experts on topics we are tackling and discussing. Now, without further ado, let's dive right in. Turkey season is right around the corner, so on this first episode of Cutting the Distance with Jason Phelps, it's all about turkeys. Today I'll be discussing a project my good buddy Steven Ranella and I have been working on for the past year, as well as dive into some of Steve's personal tips and tactics to help you harvest a turkey this season. All right, one of the big components of this podcast is going to be your questions, the users, the listeners. Since this is the first episode, we're going to go to Steve for a user-generated question.
Okay, I got a question about the questions, though. How do people submit questions?
So
I'm going to submit stuff all the time.
You're going to be our
number, like, this dude again?
You know, like on Facebook, how you get like number one top fan or like the top user? You're going to have that at the... Yeah, okay,
perfect. That's how I'm going to find. That's how I'm going to find. I'll be like...
So we're going to scour all of our social media channels, Instagram, Facebook. We're going to also have an email set up, ctd@phelpsgamecalls.com. If you have any specific questions you want us to try to hit on.
And then they can put feedback in there too.
Yeah. If you really...
You're like, that's so stupid.
Yeah, but no, we're wanting just more positive just feedback. If you have negative feedback, you can send it to Steve.
Yeah, you don't want Jason to get deflated.
Yeah. So
here's my question. Ready?
Ready.
I'm not emailing it. I'm just gonna tell you right now.
Okay. Mic to mic.
It's a three part, but they're quick. What's the longest you've ever seen a diaphragm call last? How do most people ruin them? And like, how do you take care of them and store them?
Okay, number one, I can remember this call. It was a purple piece of tape, had a star on it, because that was my number one call. And I babied that call. I think I got 4 or 5 years out of it. Competition calling and everything.
No kidding.
Yeah, babied it.
See, I thought you were going to say like 18 months.
No. When this call, when I knew it, just it hit, and it did everything it was supposed to without me having to try too hard. I put a star on it. I would take it out of the fridge, take it to my contest, use it, take it home, wash it with some cold water, let it dry on the counter, put it back in the fridge. So that one call.
So that sort of answers how you take care of them.
A little bit. Yeah. But there's,
Then hit me with like, what's the most besides setting? No, it could be, cause I've cooked a couple.
Yeah.
Leaving them on your dashboard when it's 95 degrees.
Dashboard is, I mean, cause you get the, you know, the window, you know, basically turn it into magnifying glass, hitting your latex.
Yep.
Even without the glass, I mean, you put that thing in the sun for 2 or 3 days and it's shot. You put it in front of the glass on a 90-degree day, and it's done in a day.
What about washing machine? You ran it through a washing machine?
It just depends. Sometimes it'll just toast them. Sometimes they're perfectly fine.
What about a clothes dryer?
Clothes dryer, no good.
It'll
That heat.
If you run it through a clothes dryer, you might as well pitch it.
Yeah, that heat, it usually separates the glue on the tape as well as the heat just, you know, kind of tears up that
But it
latex.
Might survive a washing machine.
It could, yep. We've had calls survive the washing machine that fall out in the bottom, pick them up, and they're... just as good as the day I built
it. Have you ever seen one survive like a dude leaves his in his bino harness or whatever the hell? I don't know. Leaves it in his, okay, I got it. Leaves it in his turkey vest. So late May comes around, turkey vest goes into a corner of the closet.
Yep.
Next year he's like, shit, where's my, oh, there it is.
It's probably going to be good.
It's probably fine.
Yeah, no sun. And then as long as you don't put it through like extreme heat cycles, they're usually pretty good.
So in a shaded like room temp closet, it's not a death sentence.
Yeah. So turkey calls are different though, because usually they're made up of multiple layers, 2, 3, sometimes even 4 layers. You get your saliva all stuck between the layers. And if it kind of dries in there, you get some different issues. You know, a lot of people make, you know, toothpick. Or they make reed spacers, so you can get like a little bit of airlift in there to let all those layers dry out. So a turkey call, as long as it's kind of allowed to dry properly, it should be fine in your turkey vest over, you know, from year to year.
And you do want to get the spit off them.
Yeah, ideally. You know, there's just bacteria and stuff in your mouth that breaks that latex down.
Yeah.
You know, sugars, coffees, you know, snooze, whatever may be in your mouth, it just creates a bad environment for that latex.
Buddy of mine, my neighbor, he always... I don't know why or how. He always brings atomic fireballs hunting.
Yep.
It's just his thing. you gotta walk a long ways. He pops in an atomic fireball. So I was out with him.
Yeah.
And I was feeling like, I feel like an atomic fireball is not good for your diaphragm.
No. Yeah, cinnamon, you know, I've got to imagine that's going to tear it down.
It's not even good for your tongue, dude.
No, I haven't did a specific study on atomic fireballs, but it can't be good. Store in the fridge. Wash it. Dry it off on the counter for a couple hours, away from a window, away from the sun.
Don't lay it in the window.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And then cold, dark place is the best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we even recommend if it's going to be a while, you can throw it in the freezer. It's not going to hurt it.
Oh, really?
Letting it actually freeze. Huh. Kills bacteria that way, too. If there was any residual on there versus in the fridge, it could potentially, you know, continue on.
I got one more then. Is there anything like there's no such thing as a warranty on a diaphragm, right? Because it's like sort of meant as like not a thing that lasts forever.
Yeah.
Like a warranty on a toothbrush.
Yeah. I mean, we've always looked at diaphragms as consumable.
Yeah.
So like it's even tough for somebody to say, I've had a call for a month and the latex is cracking. I don't know what that person did for a month, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there is. If something's obviously, you know, tape falls off, we usually try to take care of people. We listen, you know, story by story. I'm not giving any examples.
So you might look and be like, this is something that was wrong on our end.
Yeah, this could be a manufacturing defect. You know, I'm not going to lie. Like, we look at that customer about $100 in calls, and he's only complaining about one. You know, so it's obviously not the guy just trying to take us.
Yeah, I got
you. You know, so whether people want to hear that or not, like, that's how we look at it. Like, it's obviously, you know, or did somebody buy one call, and that one call's, you know, mysteriously bad after 2 weeks, like, you know, hey, here's a 40% off code. Like, you know, I don't know. We play it case by case. We never try to, you know, decide before we hear all the information.
Got it. All right. So that could have been the listener right there.
That could have been.
Asking all those questions.
Yeah. If you have similar questions to Steve's, make sure to submit them to us, ctd@PhelpsGameCalls or any of our social channels. We'll try to round those up and put them into the next few podcasts and get them answered for you.
Perfect.
All right, so we've been talking about turkey calls for a long time, back ever since we started working together, and your idea was probably like, I'd say 2 or 3 on like my crazy ass ideas I either didn't want to do or didn't think were going to work when you brought this to me. It was this idea that we were going to go somewhere, find a tree, a tree that was perfect for making turkey calls out of. We were going to go cut that tree down. Not somebody else. Not the lumber yard. Nobody's going to source it. Nobody's going to buy it. We were going to cut that tree down. We were going to tell the story of that tree, the property, the process that tree had to go to or go through in order to become a turkey call, which I think a lot of, your idea, I believe, I'm putting words in your mouth, but was the idea that people don't know the process that a tree goes through to become a turkey call and everything involved, and then tell that story. So you brought me this idea. I didn't like it.
But I need to understand. I'll tell you why I liked it, but I need to understand what was the problem with it?
It just disrupts my system, right? So my idea as a game call maker was you go to the lumber yard or you log on to, some specialty hardwood supplier. You order your 1,000 board feet of lumber and it shows up perfect, ready to be built.
Mint condition. Ready to make calls.
Whether it's me being lazy, whether whatever it was, like you just added like 14 extra steps.
Because if it's a dud tree, it's not your problem.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It would never make it to you.
So you vetted out like all of that by just... but it's also the lazy man's way. And once we got into, this idea, I'm going to say that I probably ate crow a little bit and decided it was an awesome idea. And I'm glad I got to be a part of it. But, your idea was to show this whole process. We would go cut the tree down. We were going to drive, we didn't literally drive the truck and the trailer, but we followed the truck and the trailer with the log on it to the mill. We pushed that, bandsaw, through the log. We made the decisions on the thickness the log needed to be based on, warp and splitting and all the stuff that was going to happen. We made the decision on where this was going to go. And so this was your idea that we kind of ended up partnering on and make it happen. And it was, we ended up kind of coining it the Line One Turkey Call, but I just wanted to spend the day, today's discussion and just kind of go over everything involved in this project, dive a little bit deeper and kind of see if we can, explain that project a little more to the listeners.
Yeah. I want to touch a little bit on why I thought it was cool to do it. My old man was a big woodworker. I'm not, but he was very talented and he was born during the Depression. Now you hear, there's all these places that sell like recycled wood and all this kind of stuff. And it's sort of like a thing. But to me, like the way he was, it just seemed like very frugal. He'd make knife handles with just junk he found laying around. I remember he did a bunch of siding and barn board from barn board he went and got from a barn. I remember they tore this brick building down and he got all the bricks and made me and my brothers chisel all the mortar off him so he could reuse the bricks. So he's just into that kind of stuff. Yep. But he built we built a pole barn ourselves on this piece of property that sat across the road from our house. And when we did that, we had to clear a couple oak trees out of the way. And I remember we went through all the hassle of getting those oak trees to get them milled. And then getting all the planks, and we just dried them in the garage. But getting all the planks and putting the stickers in and keeping from warping them, turning them all the damn time. And then he died. And I eventually got that wood and worked on it myself and just cut it all into strips and laminated it all into these big oak tops. And so my desk in my office is from those trees.
Nice.
And one of my smaller workbenches in my shop is made from those big pieces. And I just made these big slabs. They look like almost like a, I'm sure anybody
big
can picture
butcher block.
Yeah, it looks like a butcher block or like a, looks like you're looking at a bowling alley, whatever the hell, the lane in a bowling alley. So I kind of appreciated that stuff. And I thought that, like with turkey call, it'd just be interesting to see what all goes into it, Because before I did that, I didn't know about drying it and the whole freaking process, man. It was really instructional.
Yeah. We're kind of, as we're recording this podcast, we're kind of coming down the finish line. Everything's in production. We're pretty damn excited about kind of what we're getting out of them. It's a really cool project. And one thing I want to, you got to see kind of the picture of this tree that we picked out. We'll get into this a little bit more, but man, this wood's freaking beautiful. Like compared to what you do get at the lumberyard versus what we got out of this tree. We're pretty excited about just a beautiful call. It's different than just your straight grained walnut that you get from the lumberyard.
I'm having a guy's making me a chef's knife. That's why I'm stealing a little piece of that. Cause I'm going to have a chef's knife off it too.
Yeah. we're getting those scales sent out to you.
Yeah.
Today, actually, I think.
But so. he wants a piece with a lot of character.
Yep. We were searching for some swirl and some edges and some crotches out of it. So we'll get you some good pieces.
Yeah, I want the real, the crazy parts.
Perfect. So the release of this Line 1 kind of was hinged on the Meat Eater X Phelps release of Turkey Calls last year. We released a full line of calls, did very, very well. So some may ask, and maybe we already answered this, is why would we do this Line 1 Turkey Call? What's a need for a Line 1 Turkey Call out there? And I'm gonna see if you can answer that. Like, why do we need this call?
Oh, because I think it'd just be, I don't know, if I had... You know, you buy something, you get like a little thing with some pictures of, whatever. You buy it, you get a catalog, I don't know, from whatever the hell company you like. And there's pictures of like the people making stuff, and that you kind of like meet who works there and you see everything. I just like, why not have, if you could have a call that you could refer to, like a video that showed this walnut tree grown in Kansas. I'll point out, not far from Walnut, Kansas.
Yep.
And you can kind of like see every aspect of the tree in its context and have like drone footage of the tree dropping out of the canopy and then see the whole thing made. It would be like you like really understood every bit of it. The same way I think that one of the things I've always done with the stuff I make is we show an animal and then later we show things that came from it to eat. And people love seeing the transformation. So it's not like I would come and say like, I don't have the technical expertise to come and be like, oh, there's something about the harmonics of this wood.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, it's a cool thing to look and get a numbered call where you know there's a finite number of calls that could come from a tree, get like a video product showing everything about how it was made. And then in the end, you're holding the thing and it'll be a great hunting tool. You're holding a thing and able to hunt with it. And you have its whole history right down to the location of where the stump is. It's just like it's a fun thing. I think that anything that comes with sort of more awareness and knowledge, I remember my mother-in-law had this floor in a house that was the wood from a sheep shearing shed. And it had all the lanolin like.
Mixed on
you could feel it on the wood, right? I thought that was a cool ass floor,
yeah,
because it's just like there's like something about
the
it,
story that went behind
it. It's like it just made it like cool,
Yeah, that's acceptable.
In my office, I have a brick. You'd look at it and think it's any old brick, it happens to be a brick that came from Jim Bridger's general store when it was dismantled. Anyone else would be like, oh, he's got a red brick on his desk. I'd be like, listen, dude, it's not just any red
this
brick.
This is a special brick.
That was from Jim Bridger's store, man. Yeah. If I died and didn't tell anybody, no one would know.
Yeah,
but it just has like a thing about it that gives it substance.
I'm going to steal.
So I think these calls have like, I don't know, it's cool, man.
I'm going to have to borrow it one day off your desk.
My brick?
Yeah.
Don't build it into something. it's somewhere in this house.
So we flew to Kansas shortly after the 4th of July with the intention, at that time, I believe the intention was just to cut a black walnut tree down.
Yep.
Went on the ground. We decided to also take an Osage orange, also known as Bodark, also known as hedge.
Bodark.
It's boy D-Ark. It's like B-O-I-S. Apostrophe D.
Like wood A-R-C. Wood for making bows.
Yeah, literally by definition, wood for bows. So we decided, hey, that they got a bunch of hedge here just as well. They've got a great walnut tree.
Oh, can we talk about hedge for another second?
Sure.
These guys, I didn't realize about hedge. Makes a hell of a fence post.
Oh, yeah. Never rot. It's like, lasts forever.
And it's like a pretty fixed market value. And these guys we were with that owned this mill was like, if there's nothing else to do, you can always make some money cutting hedge fence posts. It's kind of like they're like talking about throughout their lives, like various times when it's like, you just can cut it. You can get it from owners because it's otherwise not a high value tree. It's like always in the background and be like, if you need to make a couple bucks, you can always cut Bodark hedge fence posts.
You want to know another interesting fact about fence post hedge? Like, some of the, when the osage or the hedge is used as a fence post for 60, 80, 100 years, and it's able to like basically wick or absorb some of that mud, some of that mud stained osage is like some of the highest valued timber out there.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Like it's super sought out. So I'm going to start a business where I just go around and like replace Old Farmer's fence post with like a piece of walnut so I can grab that hedge post out.
Oh, yeah,
like go
sell
like
that.
A fence post relocation business.
Clay Newcomb says it outlasts the fencing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's amazing. It's just beautiful when it's almost like just the, just streaks get sucked up into that hedge. And so you get like a really beautiful, wood layup. So another little, let's rewind a little bit before we went and picked up, the walnut and the osage. Like, how did we come, to the decision that we're going to do a pot and a striker? I know the answer because I've talked to you a lot about what you use.
Because that's what I like, man.
Yeah, yeah. We had the option to make box calls, pot calls, slotted pot calls. Like, there's all these different ideas. And we said, we can do anything within the turkey call line. And Steve's like, we're going with a pot.
I've carried around box calls for the first time I ever went in the woods with a turkey call is a box call. And I mean, I remember this, like, I remember knowing so little that we'd be out and forget the chalk. And I remember sitting there with a leather man trying to pulverize sandstone to rub. I'm not joking.
Just while hunting,
pulverize sandstone in sort of a makeshift mortar and pestle as a way to try to like chalk the box. But here's the thing with me is, let's say, you got your turkey vest on, you got everything in your freaking turkey vest, right? You got your diaphragms, you got your box, you got a pot and peg, you got whatever the hell else, your little hands, whatever device you got.
Yep.
If I all of a sudden walking down a road, okay, walking down a farm lane, and pow, a gobbler gobbles 75 yards away, in that situation, I always grab the pot.
Yep. I think
like it's just like I'm like, yeah. If I'm gonna kill this bird, this is what I'm gonna do.
Yeah, and in that situation, I bet you 99.9% of hunters aren't going to their box call. And that, so I think they got more utility. They get used a lot more.
I just have more faith that it's enjoyable for me to do it too. Like I enjoy that. I enjoy messing with one, and I know that like when I pull it out, I'm gonna like get what I want from it.
Yep.
And I see, like, I got a friend, one of the best turkey hunters I know, Robert Abernathy. He's been on the show with us. He's a turkey biologist, been hunting turkeys for a million years, all over the place, right? He's hunting turkeys now in 27 states, something like that. That dude can locate turkeys with a box.
Yep.
Like, he's got a signature locating, these just loud, aggressive cuts. And you're almost kind of like, when he does it, you're almost like, geez, really?
Yeah.
But then off in the distance, pow,
Yeah, that's what frustrates me. There's days, I remember my wife's first turkey would not answer anything else. And it pisses me off because I'm a good diaphragm caller. I'm a good on a pot call. I'm good on an owl, crow. And then he'd only answer this damn box call. Back in the day, I was using the Primo's Heartbreaker,
Yeah, I saw that.
So I was just cranking on it and that thing answered. And I literally had to box call him all the way into shotgun range because he would not answer any other call. So it was just, I'm glad I had it in the turkey vest, but it was just one of those things. Like, there are times where it works, on windy mornings, or just like a dense, foggy morning where sound isn't traveling. Like,
when Abernathy gets a strike, when he gets a strike off that box call, though, the first thing he does?
What's that?
Puts the box call away.
Yeah. It was a
locator. And then he's heading in that direction, man.
Yep.
He, the box call goes away, it's not coming back out.
Yep.
And he's like, phew. Heading that way.
So we fly into Kansas City, Missouri. We drive a little ways. I think it was about an hour and a half. And we decided on Uniontown, Kansas, is where we're going to cut this tree down. And I'd like to tell some big story on why, but it was really, I had a good buddy, Randy Milligan, who I got to hunt with last spring. I think we had advertised on a podcast, hey, we're looking for somebody with a tree. And then I think I got 40 or 50.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, 40 or 50 emails that came from Corey Calkins here at the Meat Eater, everybody offering up their tree. And it's just, it just didn't have the right feel. You're you got to come to somebody. Is it going to be the right tree? Is it kind of pre-scouted? And my good buddy Randy had reached out and said, hey, I got hedge. I've got, all kinds of black walnut, hickory. He owns quite a bit of property there on Uniontown, Kansas. And I think I shot you a message. And you're like, yeah, that'll work.
And it's no small thing to give away a walnut tree because, or to offer one up, because the one thing we learned about is you can have an expensive damn.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it takes like a perfect. I don't understand it well enough, but a veneer grade.
Yep.
Walnut, where they're taking off like paper thin concentric circles.
Yep.
Off of a walnut. And when you get one of those and there's no branches and no blemishes, you can have a tree that's worth thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember the exact number he had mentioned while we were there. Like, his neighbor just sold like a black walnut for $10,000 or something.
Yeah, it was because they're building a bank, and the bank wanted walnut veneer on the walls of the bank in certain conference rooms and stuff, but they wanted it all to match.
All like,
So they wanted like one walnut. And when you take that veneer off what we're talking about, I remember someone saying that someone handed us a business card, and it felt like a pretty heavy-duty business card, but it was a business card.
Yep.
And wasn't it like three or four layers laminated together? It's thin.
Yeah. I think Joe, the owner of the mill, handed us a business card, you know, because being a mill guy, you got to have a business card made out of
veneer.
But yeah, he told us like veneer's thinner than this.
Yeah, and it was like a few of them. But
anyways,
so when they finally found like the tree.
Yep.
That you could do the whole damn bank in it. Yes. Valuable tree, man.
Yeah.
Half of a used truck, I guess. Yeah. Nowadays.
So we kind of scouted the property. Randy kind of pre-scouted a little bit for us. And, you know, there were some options he had. But we had went there, settled on a pretty good straight black walnut. We'll talk here in a little bit about kind of, as we look at the tree, kind of how many, you know, you're looking at that tree, like that's 1,000 pot calls worth, or that, you know, we weren't looking at it like, you know, what else we were going to get out of it, or what value.
Yeah, I kept thinking like how many are hiding in there.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And then we cut down.
It'd be like looking at a chicken and being like, how many dry flies are in that chicken?
Yeah.
And that chicken's feathers.
Found a good osage orange. And then me with this, like, I'm going to blame it on their technique, this whole Eastern like sawing technique that I split the wood in half.
Crazy ass sawing technique.
Yeah, we won't get into that. So I wasted our first hedge.
Well, are you going to explain the technique and why they do it?
Yeah. We'll get into that a little bit more. So I wasted one osage. We went to another one that actually probably ended up being a better option that was right next to it. Got it, fell.
Yeah, you barber chaired it.
Yeah. I'm blaming on their technique. Like I'm from the coastal rainforest where we cut trees way different than this technique.
I never cut a tree like that. I was scared. Working on a big tree like that, I was scared because I was in unknown territory.
Yeah. I mean, we were just kind of relying on them a little bit to walk us through the technique. So then we loaded these trees up on a big flatbed, and we shipped them about an hour south to Walnut, Kansas, where we spent the next day milling these, you know, logs up to our specs. We knew we, you know, needed 5/4 for some warping and some splitting as these, you know, dried on the pallet and then as they dried in the kiln. So we set everything up to what we needed to build our ultimate pot calls out.
I like to point out that was Walnut, Kansas.
Was. We processed the walnut in Walnut, Kansas.
And I can't think about that day without thinking about the chiggers though, because we were like way dialed. When we were out cutting the trees, you know, I did all the everything you're supposed to do. I like did like permethrin on my clothes. I like pulled my pants down, did my waistline and ankles and DEET, like everything.
Yep.
As textbook. They were like, well, oh, we're going to the mill, you know? And when I'm picturing the mill, I don't know, I'm picturing like being in a building with a concrete floor. Yeah. So I got like sneakers on, like don't do anything.
Yep.
And I get to the mill is, you know, out in the backyard.
Out
in the field.
Yep.
Yeah, just like equipment out in the field, and had no idea, dude, I suffered for weeks after that.
I got lit up and I had them little baby ticks all over my calf. It was, it wasn't good.
No, I'll always think of that. I can't like think of. I honestly won't be able to look at these calls without feeling a little itchy.
So everybody that gets one of these things, they should feel a little itchy when they pick them. Like we got tore up for these calls.
Yeah, bad.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time: Seafoam motor treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who has used a can of seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way that they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Hey everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right, join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29th, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30th, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1st, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2nd, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4th, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5th, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at themeateater.com. Hope to see you at the show.
So we're out in the woods looking at these trees. I just want to explain a little bit. You know, there are board foot calculations. I know as the call designer, like when I go in to build a call, I need about 0.2 board feet per call. You know, and just to go over the board foot calculation for everybody that doesn't know, we're looking at however many inches thick this board is, by however many inches wide the board is, by how long it is in feet, and then we'll divide it by 12. And you ultimately get like 144 cubic inches makes a board foot.
So if I called someone, I'm still not totally clear on this. If I called a vendor,
yep,
and said, I want you to send me one board foot of walnut,
yep,
I would get in the mail what?
You would have to, they would then ask you, how do you want that board foot? Do you want it in 4/4 by 4 inches wide? Do you want it in 4/4 by 6 inches wide? Do you want it in 6/4 by, and then your length would then depend on like how much you, you know, how long it was would depend on the width and the thickness of that board.
But the volume, what I'm getting doesn't change.
Nope. You can get one board foot in a perfect square block, or you can get one board foot in like a board.
I got you.
Okay. So yeah, it's just a measurement of volume.
I see.
So we kind of knew that going in.
You know why that I'm confused about that now? Now I remember. You knew the thickness.
Yep.
So, all right.
I knew I needed.
I was always visualizing a board foot and what you were talking about, but I wasn't thinking that, let's say you had to make a thing that was 3 inches thick, then your whole, he damn sure not better send you a board that's 1 inch thick.
Yep. So we knew we needed a 5/4 by a 4 inch board.
That's right.
As our blank. And then the length just needed to be enough to get, you know, all those calls. And then we could basically divide that by the point.
Because in the end, the call is how thick?
The call ends up being right at just a hair over 3/4 of an inch thick.
And you go over by how much?
So we went 5/4. So we were actually cutting these boards to a true dimensional 1.25, and that was to account for all the warp. We have to plane all of these. And even on some of these boards we got off, we're going to actually lose a call at the end of the boards because by the time we planed them, they got too thin.
Huh.
So it's just, that's why we had to be so, you're literally giving up a half an inch, on the board that's going to go to waste while you're milling it compared to what we're going to get out of the board.
But when you buy it from like Joe's Lumber, you buy it the same way?
We'll buy it 4/4 in because it's clean.
Already been milled.
Yeah, we know that it's going to be perfectly straight and we won't have any waste on that.
I see. So part of that was just knowing you're getting into like a...
Yeah, we're not buying that.
You're going to have to grade it yourself.
Yep. So we were doing a lot of, you know, all of the measurements are like, we brought Seth along to help us, you know, forestry degree. But a lot of the dimensions are just taken at what's called breast height. You know, so a normal human's about 4.5 feet. their breast height. You take a measurement on what they think that diameter is. You know, those, some of the guys that were working with us there, they're so experienced. They kind of just hugged the tree, kind of figured out, well, I think that's about a 24 incher. And then you can kind of go to a chart. You know, there's two different dimensions. There's like a Doyle chart, and then there's like a quarter inch chart. And that kind of gives you an idea of how many board feet they think they're going to get based on like a 16 foot straight section.
Yeah. And those dudes we were with that deal in a lot of lumber, they're also looking at the big limbs.
Yep.
And they just kind of, that's just like seriously eyeballing, but he's just looking up in the tree and being like, oh, X more on that limb's probably nothing.
Yeah. Or if they had a curve to them, like even when that dries, the board's just going to go completely crazy and it's not going to be usable anyways. You know, so they were walking through all that, or that limb's 10 feet long.
Yeah. I forgot that too. Like depending on the limb's length and how it was oriented to the tree, he would gauge like how it's going to dry.
Yeah.
And he'd be like, you're going to have a mess.
Yeah. Because
like, that limb will be a mess.
I mean, you got to think of that limb as basically like a big diving board, right? So the bottom side of that tree is having to, you know, it's under a bunch of stress compared, or the top side of the tree's in tension, the bottom's in compression, you know? So you're trying to, you know, think of when that board dries, it's going to want to settle out and it's going to get all warped and messed up. So,
you know what? When I was down in South America, they have a lot of those buttressed, those big jungle trees that have like the buttress roots.
Yep.
And some of these buttress roots, you could cut a tabletop out of them.
It's huge.
I mean, it's like you're standing at the tree and the buttress, which looks like a descending ridge line, coming off the tree is taller than you. And it looks like it's like positioned to sort of like block the tree up. But they're explaining that that's a cable pulling on that tree.
Yeah. It's just like a,
it's not reinforced. It's not like, it's not
pulling
like
it up.
It's, yeah. It's not like, I guess building a retaining wall.
Yeah. It's pulling it down.
That thing's going to try to get it back where it should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes like, kind of like logging with the big yarder, all those cables just kind of pulling that thing into being straight up versus,
yep, exactly.
Next, I want to get into like the crazy way they taught us to cut these trees down. And we kind of just, you know, when you're in their ballpark, you play by their rules.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I live in maybe the timber capital of the world there in Southwest Washington, you know, come from a long lineage of tree fallers. And we show up and I think there was some wind damage or a big storm right before we got there. And they actually had to cut a tree down before we got there.
Oh, they had junk laying everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. And they kind of, I think I kind of stood there and kind of got out of the way, but kind of watched and like, what in the hell are they doing?
It's zero, because they're dealing with high dollar hardwoods.
Yeah. So, I mean,
they have a zero waste cut.
Yeah. Their stump is literally flush with the ground.
And they don't knock a wedge out.
No, just
because you'd be throwing away $100. I don't know.
Yep. They put a little teeny face cut in, just a little one. Remember, we had just.
But I mean, it's like you're losing a saw width.
Yep.
And they core, you always have to make like a diagram.
Yeah.
So scary. I thought it was scary doing that.
So I'll do my best to describe it and you can add some details. We cut a small face cut into the direction we wanted the tree to fall. And normally after you cut your larger face cut in like a Douglas fir tree around home, you then come in from the backside of the log and steer your saw perfectly square to that direction. And you approach your holding wood. I can't remember if you're up, you know, a little high or whatever, but you approach your wood until the tree starts to tip and you get out of there. Well, here we cut our face notch in a lot shallower.
In the dirt.
Yeah, more offset towards the way you want. And then you came directly behind the holding wood and you dogged the nose of your saw in and left that 1 inch. So now you've basically got your saw stuck to the center of the tree, notch, let's say, to the right. And then you saw your way out the back side of the tree.
And hollow the whole thing out.
Yeah. And then when you get to the end, they want you to kind of work a little bit quick and just kind of zip through, and then the tree falls.
Yeah. So you got, that's a good way of putting it. You got a face cut. You got a gap of wood. Then the whole damn tree's gone. And you got the other face just barely holding on. And you just nick that thing. Yep.
And then the tree falls.
And it's a clean
cut. It worked. Yeah. And I mean, they literally, you know, at home, We leave a 2 foot stump, you know, so you go to a clear cut and there's all these damn stumps everywhere. This thing's literally like, if somebody didn't tell you, you're walking through the wood, that there's a tree cut down over there. I mean, you wouldn't know it was there.
You drive a lawnmower over.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was flush. So it was a kind of cool little way that they showed us. And like I said, we were in their arena. That's how they were comfortable cutting trees down. So
I know how people can learn what we're talking about. They don't need a diagram.
The video.
They can watch damn video.
Yeah. Man, that tree you fell. I had 50 ticks on my hand when I went to reach for that damn camera. They were everywhere. So then we took them down to the mill.
We'll fast forward to that. Loaded them up with skid steers, you know, loaders, all of that. Got them chained down on the
trailer. Yeah, we kind of bucked it into just whatever natural. We didn't buck it to length.
No, we bucked it to
whatever made
to
the tree.
Points where we were going to, you know, things were getting curvy or we were going to start to lose, you know, to limbs and whatnot. Just what made sense for good lumber. And then we moseyed on down the next morning to Walnut, Kansas, down to the mill. And
big ass bandsaw out in the field.
Yep. And so we loaded, I think, Walnut on first. You know, they take their cuts. They start to see what we're actually, you know, you don't know what you got until you start to open up the wood. And we could tell right away it was going to be, you know, really pretty wood. And so we started loading the walnuts up, got those all cut at 5/4. New for an Osage, you know, based on different woods, Osage is really, really hard. It's got like a specific gravity of 0.8. So it's really heavy. Matter of fact, I think I seen a statistic. It's got like one of the highest, BTU ratings, like for firewood, like it's going to burn the hottest. So it's got the most energy stored up in it. So it's a real dense, one of the reasons it makes an absolute amazing striker. So we cut that at 4/4, knowing that a striker was going to end up being, you know, right at 3/4 inch on an Osage by my designs. And so we milled the Osage up at 4/4, milled the walnut up at 5/4, and then kind of just told them, you know, what the optimum boards to ship to the kiln was going to be.
Yeah, I want to add a thing quick about these dudes that we milled with. They used to have, there was an old gas well on their property, and the gas well went dry, but it still has natural gas in it. They had rigged up where they were pulling natural gas like next to their mill, and then they had a natural gas, whatever the hell we call it, saw.
Yep.
They converted this old tractor engine to burn natural gas, and that powered their old mill.
Yeah.
And they had a totally self-contained unit.
The thing about the old mill, like I sit there and kind of scratch my head, and then I kind of walk away like, man, these guys just do what they need to do. Like they had this old tractor motor that was the drivetrain was hooked to an old rubber tire, and that's what fed the logs. They pulled a lever of a spinning rubber tire that would spit the log
to engage the blade.
Would engage the blade, and then it spun the log through. I'm just like, this can't be like OSHA approved. But
no, if you looked around a while, I think you'd find some limbs. You'd be like, oh, there's a thumb bone.
Yeah, but I kind of like that. I mean, I don't know if hopefully that comes out in the story, but like this is the way that some of this stuff gets done. Like just real, you know, down to earth people running mills out in their backfield.
Yeah.
That's how you get some of this lumber. Shipped it to a kiln. We decided to ship the green lumber, meaning wet, no drying at all. The green lumber got put on a semi-truck and shipped to Addy, Washington, where we had it shipped to a kiln. The nice thing about a kiln, so if I was to just take those boards that we milled up and say we wax the ends so we can control the way that the board actually dried out. We don't want the board to dry out the ends. We want the board to dry out like on its face of a surface so it doesn't crack.
Yep.
So you'd wax or paint the ends of the board, let it dry. We usually say that it takes about a year per inch of thickness. So we just don't have that kind of time, right? So we use these kilns to speed up this process to get
That's natural. That's ambient.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. If I was just to throw it in a shop and put little dunnage, you know, little spacer sticks in between it so air can get all around it, it's going to take a year an inch. We don't have that kind of time.
Well, is the kiln a different quality of drying, or is it just you wind up with the same thing?
I mean, ultimately, our optimum moisture content's around 7 to 8%. So
you're landing in the same place.
Yeah, I need that moisture content so that board is done moving at the time we put a drill bit, a mill, a lathe, anything to it, any of the process, that board's not going to move or warp on us anymore.
Yep.
So we're shooting for 8%. Now, what the kiln does is you put a bunch of steam vapor in there. So you're actually adding moisture to the situation, but then you can draw that moisture down in like a controlled process. So you don't get all the splitting and warping as much. You can control that a lot more by basically bringing up the moisture to what the board has and then slowly environment, pull that out. Not to bore everybody with that process. It took us about 6 weeks to get our Osage and Walnut down to that 7 and 8%. And then from there, we have to look at these boards that we now have ranging anywhere from 8 to 12 inches and kind of pick out what's going to give us our best boards. If we need 2 4-inch strips, some of it's going to go to waste anyway. So we're kind of looking, evaluating the boards, where are checks, where are soft spots, where are knots, you know, entered into that board. And we kind of just go back and we're kind of doing our best to kind of grade the lumber or kind of cherry pick what we want out of it.
So where you're at now, how many do you think we're hiding in that tree?
So we think, and we, you know, I'm going to give some of our tips away or tricks, but we're completely transparent on this process. We think we can get about 1,450
Oh, really?
Pots. We're going to say we're shooting
for... So we're doing better than our we're doing way better than our goal of that we wanted a tree with 1,000 in it.
Yep. So I think we're going to be around 1,400, and that's to give us 50 extras. Because along the process, if you have a tool catch, you know, a pot, it blows up. Well, you're like, well, all right, number 1,342 is missing. You know, we got to replace it. And so you got to kind of shoot for a number lower than what you have.
And then my knife handle.
Yeah, we keep getting these damn requests for knife handles and stuff that are cut. No, that's going to be an extra. That's just basically going to be scrap. So we're shooting for 1,400. And what that's going to end up giving us, and we haven't talked about it a lot, we've decided on a pure crystal surface, so not glass. We went pure crystal over a Pennsylvanian slate tone board inside of the walnut pot. And then we're going to have a one-piece custom Osage orange striker.
One piece. Oh.
We ended up being able to make that happen after a lot of, I'm like, come on, pressure's on, guys. Like, you need to just like, so there's times where I'm not going to lie, super inefficient to like literally run. We take a 1 by 1, 1 inch by 1 inch piece of Osage, run it through a doweling machine. So it basically spits out a broom handle. But normally you want to get like 3 to 4 foot broom handles. We're getting 16 inch broom handles.
Oh,
but
really?
That's just to get one more striker out of the board.
But do you think you're going to be able to match it in strikers?
Yeah, that's where we...
Like you'll get the number.
The concern with the lower number was if we were to just... If this was mass production and efficiency and time was involved, we wouldn't have got that many. But since we said, all right, let's throw the efficiency away and just go hunt for every single striker and every piece of Osage we have, they were able to go like pull these ones and twos out of boards where we would normally scrap and just say it's worth burning.
Yep. So, now, when you watch the video, you'll see the Osage too.
Yep. Yep.
You'll see where it came from.
So we've got that all packed. I mean, just everything we're doing on this is the, like Steve said earlier, just create an experience to go along with that pot call. And I think when everybody kind of sees the end product, they're going to agree, like, there isn't a pot call with, you know, this much thought put into anything as far as even the dang packaging that we decided to come up with. Just, you know, everything from top to bottom on this is we didn't spare any expenses in the process, tried to make just a real one-off. You know, the art on the call is going to be, you know, kind of one-off. Nobody else has did this again. So I'm really excited.
No, that's beautiful, man.
Yeah, it turned out great.
I mean, the whole thing's beautiful. And tell people when they're going to be done.
These Line 1 calls should be available right now at themeateater.com.
You know the term Line 1? There's a line of cattle that they've been researching for a long time. It's called like the Line 1 Hereford. Yep. And I always liked that. And I always made me wonder about the Line 2 Hereford.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to
find
it.
I don't know where he is. But so when we're thinking about, I was like, no, it's the first one. It's the Line 1.
Yeah, no, I love the name when you kind of... I think we were in Kansas when you brought that up. I'm like, I don't have any objections to that name. And, you know, for a while there, we had kind of coined it Tree to Turkey. Since our intention at the end of this is for me and you to hopefully go back there one of these years, whenever our schedules line up, and kill a turkey
from the
on
stump.
That property. And the funny story
You don't like this part, but I think I'm going to do it from the stump.
You're going to sit on that stump?
I'm going to sit on that stump.
So, I mean, a funny story. I hunted with Randy this year. I literally killed my turkey within... No more than a quarter mile from where the walnut and Osage was cut down.
Yeah.
So,
turkeys cool have definitely walked under that tree.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. It's a good piece of property. Yeah. Randy does a good job there, has got a lot of turkeys. All right, we went a little bit long there on the Line 1 discussion, but what this podcast is meant to do is bring you tips and tactics, and we don't want to leave without asking Steve a question to kind of get some of his input on one of these questions. So I'm going to pose a situation for Steve. You're in an area with good bird numbers, all kinds of good turkey habitat. You know, you got a good mix of ag, roost trees, feed, cover, everything a turkey needs, nesting. But the state you're hunting only lets you get a tag that's good for 2 hours of the day. So you're going to have to pick your time, whether you want to be from...
I like the state. It's an interesting state.
Yeah. So yeah. It's, you know, you can pick a time from, let's say, roost to 7:30, whatever it is. What time are you going to choose?
9 to 11.
9 to 11.
Yeah.
Can you give me...
Maybe 10. No, 9 to 11. I was vacillating between 10 to 12 and 9 to 11. Here's the thing. If you got to be there since day... Like, I don't like going out late. You hear about people that get older and they just get up, eat breakfast, and go in the woods. Like, I like to be there as part of the package to be there from dawn. I like to be there at daybreak. I want to hear him on the trees. Yep. I like all that. But there's a thing that happens where if I'm sitting there in the dark and I hear a turkey, I don't have overwhelming confidence that I'm going to kill that turkey. But there's something about 10 a.m. You're half thinking about taking a nap, you know?
Yep.
And you haven't heard anything in a couple hours. It's been pretty slow. And at 10 a.m., all of a sudden, pow, I always get like, we're going to kill that bird.
Yeah, yeah. That bird, yeah. You know, it's exactly, yeah. I mean.
Like, he's like done doing, like when he came out of the tree, he had like an agenda. He's like got his hands. He's going to some specific spot, whatever he's going to do. They seem to oftentimes, like they know what they're going to do when they get out of bed.
Yep.
And then it gets late morning and they seem to enter, there's variables like where they're at in the breeding cycle nesting and all that. But you get birds that they get to be around that time of day and all of a sudden it's like he's got free time.
Exactly. Yeah. And when he hammers off there, you're like, he probably doesn't have a hen with him, you know? Yeah. Or if he does, he's not.
He's like, now what am I gonna do? I don't feel like just laying around dusting. I feel still got a little spunk.
Yeah.
And sounds off, then I'd get real excited.
Yeah, and that's so you're saying if I could paraphrase, you'd be a spectator. You'd still go out, you just wouldn't carry your shotgun from daylight.
Oh, that's how I would handle it.
To 9:30. You're just still gonna go out there for that experience, but you're gonna walk back to your truck at 10 and grab
your gun.
I'd
check the regs and make sure it was okay for me to just go listen. And then I'd go back and get my gun. No, I'd go get my gun at 9 o'clock. Because I want to be ready for 10 o'clock.
Okay. So you're trying to hit it like prime in the middle there.
Yeah, I might even take a little nap. I might take a nap. I might take a 20-minute nap from like at 9:10, sleep to 9:30, and then get ready for my 10 a.m.
Gotcha. Because this question stemmed from, me being a young turkey hunter, high school. I would jump in my car, bomb over to Eastern Washington where we had all the turkeys and go. And, we were up 2 hours before daylight, hiking in. We want to sit under the tree. We'd watch those birds for, a day or two do this. And you'd go set up thinking you'd never kill them off the damn roost. I don't know if it's because I accidentally made a noise. Screwed them up, but no matter what, I can pattern turkeys for 20 days in a row, do the same thing, and I sit under that tree on the 21st day, and they will not do what I need them to do to kill them. I don't know what it is. I don't know if they've got like a sensor. Maybe it's because I can't keep my damn call to myself. Why
they got a
the
tracking
tree.
Device on you?
But the old timers there used to say, "We'll let you young bucks get up and get the turkeys all ready for us. We're gonna sleep in. We're going to eat a good breakfast. When you guys are now taking your nap or coming in to eat breakfast or lunch, we're going to go out and kill the turkeys.
We're going to come out and kill all your turkeys."
Yeah. And
well, the real old timers would go out at night and crawl in under the tree.
So yeah, it's curious. I think I'm with you, especially as it gets, later April, early May, at least where I hunt, that midday is just kind of, that, like you said, that's the bird that when it gobbles, you're like, we got this one.
Yeah.
No, I like it. I like it. So, Steve, why we've got you here before we close, if you had any tip or tactic that you can give to a new turkey hunter to maybe help them find some success, like what's the most important thing as a new turkey hunter that you'd care to share with them?
It's so hard because what I want to say, like everything has exceptions.
Yep.
What I want to say is developing the ability, until you start learning turkey behavior, develop the ability to control your impulses. Like as a beginning turkey hunter, you're going to make more mistakes of moving too soon and being too aggressive early on. You're going to move too soon and be too aggressive and bump too many turkeys.
Yep.
Later, when you start learning a lot more, you'll learn like just how aggressive you can be, but things might not happen as quick as you want them to happen. And if you got a bird and you're calling to it, working it, and he leaves, learning when it's like, man, I would go in that direction, but I can tell by how loud the leaves are, by how open the country is, there's just no way.
Yeah, that
plan. I'm going to get up and he's going to see me.
Yep.
So early on, be like, I don't know, admit to yourself, I don't know a ton about birds yet. Every part of me wants to get up, but I also know I'm probably going to blow it. And just be a little more patient until you get good enough and you've watched enough turkeys to start being a little more adventurous.
Yep.
But I screwed up a lot by going too hard, and then there he is staring at you.
Yep. Yeah, so cautious, patience, a little more as a beginner until you kind of learn, what you can get away with and what you can't.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like learning what you can get away with.
Yep.
Learning, like, I shouldn't, but in this, like, you'll wind up saying this to yourself. I shouldn't do this, but I know that right now it's okay.
Yep.
You know?
And one thing, I mean, what you're saying is in order to learn that though, you're going to bump birds. I mean, even with being cautious, I think Steve's telling you to be a little bit extra cautious.
Like err on the side of not moving.
But then to ultimately learn what you can and can't get away with, you're going to have to bump birds somewhere down the line. But to start with, just like you say, be a little more reserved. I really appreciate having you here, Steve. So what we're going to say is go check out themeateater.com somewhere on or around the 24th.
Yep.
Line one turkey call. A really cool experience. Like I say, I kind of joke with Steve as I thought his idea wasn't great and I didn't like it to begin with, but I became a believer about halfway through the process and I'm really excited to see this through. If you had to pick one time and you wanted to maybe see Steve out in the turkey woods under a tree, you're going to want to go between 9 and 11 because that was the time that Steve picked for being out there as far as notching, his turkey tag on a turkey. And other than that, if you're a new turkey hunter, maybe be a little more cautious until you kind of get the turkeys figured out what you can get away with and what
you
can't.
As a friend of mine put it, when you feel like doing something, don't.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
All right, thanks, man.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Hey guys, turkey season is in full swing right now, and if you are planning on getting after it, make sure to pick up some Meat Eater Phelps turkey calls to stuff into the old turkey vest or into your fanny pack right now. I carry a few different things. I like to use mouth calls, and I like to use pot calls. Mouth calls or diaphragms, I like them because it gives you hand-free calling, meaning when you're working a bird up close, you can have your gun on your knee, finger on the trigger, ready to roll, and still be making turkey sounds. I like pot calls because I just like pot calls. I enjoy calling with a pot call. Whatever direction you go, including a box call, which I don't personally use too much, but they're fun and great, and I started out with them. Yanni, on the other hand, one of my main turkey hunting buddies, he loves box calls. And what's funny is I'll now and then look to him and give him the look that means get out your box call and find us a turkey. So it's not that I don't like them. I just have Yanni use his. Then I don't have to carry it. Go to Phelps Game Calls. Get calls that are made in the USA and get calls that'll get them close. Find yours at PhelpsGameCalls.com today.